before, you went to work for Consolidated Paper Company.
I started at the paper company in about 1933. I was born in Toledo, Ohio in 1915, and I moved to Monroe 4 years later. And until I was 14 or 15, in boyhood days, I just played around Monroe and did the usual things. We used to swim in the quarry and so forth until around the age of 14 or 15, and then they began old enough to go around together, and I'm speaking of my friend Elmer Mulligan, who we were pretty good pals. So we got a invitation to go and go through the junk that was taken out of the breakers at the Consolidated Paper Company, and we were told this by my grandfather, who was the felt man at the company at that time, and he washed the felts. There were three felts on a machine, and his job was to wash them probably every 10-12 days. And also he made rosin size, which is made of a chunk of rosin. They would put it in a tank and heat the rosin with water and have an emulsification. And that was his job, and his son was a helper, Russell. And that was their job. But the main thing is that when they emptied the breakers, he would know about it, and he would tell me, and then I would call my friend Alan Mulligan, and then we would go down to the Consolidated that day and wait until they emptied the breaker, which was getting all the paper sack out of it, and in the bottom was a bunch of metal stuff. Any junk that didn't go through the breakers would be in a pit right in front of the blades that cut the paper out, and they would take a shovel, and a shovel was a very handy tool in those days, and the next handy tool was a wheelbarrow. Remember, I'm speaking back when they didn't have electricity, electric trucks and so forth. So they would tell us when they emptied the breaker, they would take about maybe 4 or 5 wheelbarrows out of the breaker, wheel it in front of the door, dump it on the floor, and then around this bunch of things. Now remember that we're back in the days when a penny looked pretty good. So we begin to scratch through there, and first thing you know, a penny come, maybe I'd get a nickel, maybe I'd get a dime, once in a while even a quarter. And everybody around there was picking up the money. Doesn't seem like much nowadays, but a quarter in those days was a pretty good find. And you can see how the times have changed now. They wouldn't bother with it. It would probably go all down in the dump. That's where when we got done with it, why they'd shovel it back into a horse-drawn wagon. We would take it out and dump it in the dump back of the mill. And we used to go, when my father, who was the clerk, they had the one on a stock gang. Now he would do all the weighing, and he would do the judging of the stock that came in by cars and truck. Now his job was to weigh all of this paper, but it became too much for him to do, so they needed another one, and I was chosen as the waymaster down there. And then at the age of about 18, just when I got out of the 12th grade or school, I had a job right away of a waymaster down there. It was not too steady because the star gang didn't have to work too many hours a week sometimes, but it was a job. And from there, I gradually worked on different jobs.
For how long did you work as a weighing clerk?
Well, I lasted on as a weighing clerk about 3 or 4 months. It was during the first months after I got out of school, which would be probably September, October, and November. And then I got a job working in number 7. Now, number 7 was a solid fiber plant, and the paper in there was probably 100 point. When I say 100 point, I mean 100 thousandths of an inch, which is a pretty heavy paper. It would come off from the paster. The paster which the Consolidated had would take rolls of paster and paste them together. Might seem like a little thing, but the rolls would weigh about 4 or 5 tons, and they would take and put four or five of those rolls and paste them together. So that's a lot of paper moving in there to paste together, and the sheets coming out on the finished end of the paster were fairly big and heavy. 100 and 100 to 120 point is quite a heavy paper. And those papers were the ones that would be manufactured in number 7. And they would be bar creasers and Knowlton's and Cottrell's and ream cutters to cut the paper to the exact size. Now, a ream cutter might seem old to most people, just a paper cutter. Well, it would cut a bunch of paper about 6 inches tall and about 6 feet square. Could cut it to any size you wanted, cut it right in half. And these papers would be cut to a certain size, and then they would go through a bar creaser, which I used to run, and would take one sheet at a time and pass it along a guide, and they were stops where to make a score in the paper, and then you would pile them up on one side, and there would be someone there to keep the pile in that you were feeding in there to get the scores, and a pile on the other side taking it away. And from there it would probably go to a Knowlton where they would put the other scores, the scores that are parallel to the grain of the paper, so that the flaps of the box would be able to bend over, and then the Knowlton would cut a little slit out so that you could have enough room to fold the carton into a box. Everything would, and it cut the one for the glue flap. But there, that's as far as we would go with the Consolidated. They would be put on one end of the machine, and they would clean it off and pile maybe a 5 foot or 6 foot load, and put a steel band around it and band it up and put it on a truck, and it would go to the company that wanted their case for whatever they were using it for. They use it for almost anything, especially heavy stuff, because this was solid fiber, not corrugated. It was solid fiber paper. Then they would put the things like a jack or maybe a part of a car or something would go in them. But That was all the goof laugh, of course, was done at the place where the part was to be manufactured. Ford Company or anything like that, whoever wanted the cartons, they would use the case, and they would either put a little glue on the flap then and fold it up, bake their case, and then staple it up, and then you have your box. Then from there I...
How long did you do this job?
Well, I was there about probably a year and a half. So I got to that was pretty handy at using the machinery in the number 7. And then I had a chance to go to the main box shop. That was the four-story plan at the end of First Street, if you can remember there, with the big water tower on top. And I had a chance there to get a job in the second floor ream cutters. Then I worked at the ream cutters. Now these cutters that I'm talking about would cut the paper for the box shop or any company that wanted some paper at a certain size. And again, these ream cutters are ones that would cut 5 or 6 inches of paper, and any length, probably we could cut at least 60 by 60 if anybody ever wanted it that big. It wasn't usually that big, but we could trim that whole sheet around. But most of the time was a 40 by 60 or something for the sheet that would be run on the presses upstairs. So I worked on the ream cutters for a couple of years, and then I got a chance to go up in the cutting room. Now in the cutting room there was cutting presses, cotrels they call them, and one sheet at a time. At those days, I'm talking days when they didn't have too much equipment yet. The equipment was getting a little better. They did have some electric trucks then, but to move the loads around. And as the years grew on, they got better trucks and lift trucks, and which made the jobs a lot easier. But as far as the equipment on the presses themselves, that didn't improve yet. They would put the whole load of paper in the back, and then they had a lift. It'd lift the paper up, and then it'd slide toward the feeder. The feeder would take one sheet at a time and kind of fan it out, and it'd go against two stops, and then against the horizontal stop, so you're, in other words, three, and then the press would come around and catch the sheet and bring it around the cylinder, and it would meet the die. The die was going back and forth on the bottom, and the cylinder would go around and meet it, like something like your, if you saw the presses were on a newspaper, the cylinders would turn around and they would meet the other cylinder. Well, this was a flat blade, and it would cut where it was supposed to cut on the box, and it would score where it was supposed to score on the box, in order that when it got done, you had a perfect box. Now these were already printed, or they may be just a plain box you'd want. I could give you a good example of a box that we made, and we made hundreds of thousands of them, maybe a million, I wouldn't know. But it was the Arm & Hammer soda box, and we still got it, we see it today. It was a blue back paper made on the machines with a blue back, and it was printed in the printing room. And when it come down there, when we got done with it, it was a flat box. And in this case, There was probably maybe 20 of them on one sheet of paper. Well, they would let each sheet would come out and land in a catcher, and they would maybe get 50, 60 sheets up there, 3 or 4 inches of stock. Then we would pull it, then they would, whoever was cleaning them, I did a lot of cleaning. They would pull it down and pull the whole 3 inches out, and with the, probably 40 boxes that was on there, we'd start with a little hammer and go around and tap out all the scrap on the rod that was around them, and get the 40 boxes out, and they were all cut and scored, and of course they had been printed. I'm talking about, I didn't work in the printing room then. They were all cut very well, and then they were piled on a flat to go to the gluers. At that time, I was just working in the cutting press, and that was probably, maybe 5 years after I had been down there, 5 or 6 years. So then I had a chance and got up in the printing room to where that I got a chance to do a little feeding on the printing presses. They were mealy presses up there. One sheet would go in. See, it's still the days when the automatic pickups and feed for the press wasn't on there. So you would take one sheet at a time and go against two guide and then slide it over to the third guide, and the clamps would come around and catch it, and it would go across the plates, printing plates. Now this would be in an encased the arm or hammer, would put all the printing that you see on it with the yellow, I guess, yellow on it, and somebody there with the hammer, I don't know, whatever's on the arm and hammer today was still on there. And the printing press would pile them up in a catcher, but they would only stack maybe 6 or 7 inches on a flat. And then they would shove an arrangement of sticks in there, let them fall on the stick while they dropped the flat out, pulled the flat out from under it and put it in another flat and brought it up and then pulled it out so that the printing wouldn't get too heavy as to make it stick. It wouldn't make the sheets stick together, and they would go over and set on a waiting room. In other words, they'd give maybe a couple days there, and then if it was nice and dry, then they would go down where I was in the cutting room. Then we go to the gluers, and I was on the gluers, and I got to be a setup man on the gluers at one time. And all they do on the gluers, they had a stack of them, and they had belts over there that would take the bottom one, and you put in there we're talking about the arm and hammer box. They would put a stack of boxes in there, and they would go out of there just about as fast as you couldn't count them that fat. And they'd go out there, and they'd look, they would look like a kind of a tail going through there, and they would go across the glue applier. It was a little wheel that would run through the glue and put it on the glue flap, and it'd fold it over, then it would go through a kind of a long run with a little weight on it. And the girls on the back of that machine, they were all girls back there catching. And every 50 boxes or whatever you wanted, they would kick one out, so they'd take that 50 and put them in a case, a corrugated case, if they got them from our north side plant, or they never put them in solid fiber cases. They come from the north side, they'd have a case, and they'd fill it up, and they had tapers and paper tape then when we first started, but by the way, plastic was hardly known, kind of an unknown thing. Plastic in those days? No. It was paper tape. You had the paper ones. You've probably seen them now in some stores still have paper tape. It's a kind of a gum on there, and you push a tape on it, and you would tape the case up, and it'd be all ready. They put the cases on a flat, and in the truck waiting, or in the car, doesn't matter, anything would go out. So that was probably the end of my box shop days.
As I understand it now, you must have worked your ways through each process of the paper making, and I do not know anything about it, but it sounds very interesting. Did you have more advances in the paper mill, or did your wages increase, and were there any other, was there, for instance, a union in the plant?
In the plant there was a union. We had a papers union, and we had a strike down there. Probably anybody in Monroe could remember. We were out for probably, I think it was a month or something. I was out on a picket line out there with the rest of them, and brought my amateur radio station out there. I was talking to people around the country on the amateur radio out on the picket line. But it was all resolved. Now getting back to the last days when I was a set-up man in the gluing department, that was the last one I had. There came an opening for a man in the lab. Well, of course, I had schooling in 12, then I had physics and chemistry, and I had a little pull on the Hugh Osborne, who was the employment manager, and I told him the job came open in the lab. And boy, did I put my name on that fast, and I got the job. And now this was getting in the war days. See, that was 2 years later, because I had all the other jobs, but this is about the war days. So I had a job now testing the machines, testing for the machines. The paper coming off from the machines was all tested. And at the time that we were running government contracts, which kept me out of the war, because I was 40, I was married, and I had one child. So that kept me out of the war on account of we were making a paper there that was asphalt, and it was I couldn't tell you what it was for. It was for shells of some type. And the machines were making that, and I got a job testing. They brought me around. They had somebody work with me for probably a week. I would go out there, and we would test on the paper. We would test the mullion, the weight, and the caliper. They were the main ones, and asphalt, and the pH of the vats, a pH which you probably all heard of it when you talk about a swimming pool. Well, it's the same thing on a paper machine. We try to keep it at a certain. The mullion, I can give you a very quick thing. A mullion is the bursting test of the paper. It takes so many pounds per square inch to knock a hole in it. It had a rubber diaphragm that it pushed through it. The weight, you cut a square foot and you put it in a special scale you had, and they tell you how many pounds per thousand square feet. And then the caliper would be thousandths per inch. You had a regular gauge there that you put it under and lift it up, stick the paper on there, to tell you maybe 20 point, 30 point. Our machines were running paper from 16 to probably 35 point, but somewhere between them. Most of the time we were running about 18 to 25. I think the government paper was about 26 point, 26 or 27. I can't really remember the whole one, but that was back in around 1938 or 40, somewhere in there. We were making the shells. And then we would have to go to the wet end of the machine. Now, that's quite a walk. That's quite a walk to go to the end of the machine. So we'd get the samples that they would save us out of the roll. The men would cut them off, cut us off a strip, and then we'd bring that up to the lab and cut off six pieces out of it, two from the front, two from the back, and two from the center. But we'd have to go to the back of the machine and get the filler and the underliner and the top liner pHs and bring them back and take them, because they wanted to try to keep the paper somewhere near neutral if we could, usually around 7.2, somewhere in there, a little bit on the acid side. But if it got down to getting too much alum in the paper, and then bring it down to maybe 5.64 or something like that in the chlorophenol red range. Well, we would go down and tell the machine tender, and he'd turn out a little more chlorine. We used a lot of chlorine in my life down there too. Probably in my life I put on maybe 400 or 500 tons. When we put on a tank of chlorine, it was a ton tank, and we'd have to take care of those too. That was a job in the lab. Change those tanks. We had to watch the gauge and make sure that it was on there. And by the way, this testing was for three machines: machine 5, 6A, and 6B. And if we were running box shop paper, it was once an hour. If we were running rolls, it was every roll. And what we did hate, did we hate, was to get the government order, because if the rolls weren't too big in diameter, they probably only run about maybe 27, 26 inches in diameter. And we had to test every roll, and they'd run about 30 minutes. So every 30 minutes, we had to go down there and get that roll for the government, as they want every roll. And the test on that roll was asphalt besides. They put asphalt in the paper. And that's a process back there that's very interesting, still on paper making. And someday, if anybody ever wanted to know how paper was made, that would take quite a story too, and tell them how they get asphalt in the paper. So we'd have to run there and then get a small sample, not very, about 1x3, and put them in a tube, and we had a solution. I don't know if I even forget the name of what it was. But we would take the asphalt out of the paper, weigh it first, and then take the asphalt out, and then dry it up, and then weigh it again and see how much asphalt was in there, and put it down. If it wasn't enough, we would have to go down and tell the machine tender right away, because government's specifications were pretty strict.
Did you need any special training for all this, for the additional jobs that you did?
Well, you did have to know your math and so forth. Math was quiet. You should know chemistry, because you were doing quite a lot of chemical work. And so the testing days were semi-professional job. It took a little knowledge to be able to use common sense on what to tell a machine tender. Then,
did the company send you out someplace to get some additional training?
Now, getting down to the main job that I had, this was after the government. This was probably in around 1950, maybe 50-55, somewhere in there. We had a lot better equipment. The electric trucks were in there, and we had the different kind of feeders, and things were better. But then we had a different management, of course, and the management over there didn't keep the way I see it. The management that we had kind of kept our equipment equal to what was an average of the country. But the company that took it over kind of let it lag, and we got behind on that. But I still got my job as calendar-sized man. Now, that was seemed like a funny thing, but the calendars are the last thing that the paper goes through before it's wound or cut. The last thing on there, and there's three stacks of calendars. And on the calendars, there is a solution put. You would have problems, you see it. It's a box made that leans against an iron rule. And there's a king rule, the queen rule, and about four other iron rules. And it probably amount to about 30 tons, I guess, altogether. But the paper is going through that. And a good many person lost their ends of their fingers over there trying to feed that through the calendars, because it was fed through by hand. They would cut a tail and then feed the tail through, and then one on each side of the calendar, and go around from the top row. They were one above another, and they had three stacks of that they had to go through to finish it. And of course, these liquid, as soon as they got it through all good, but they turned this liquid on, which I made. And most of it was carboxymethylcellulose, which closed the paper up. And I made about maybe 30 or 40 different kinds of things to put on it. I had six holding tanks, and they were probably 40,000 gallon tanks, pretty big tanks, and they were up, and I had to go up stairway every time to turn a valve to put it in this tank and put it in that. But I could put the colors in the sizing and change the color of the paper, but it never seemed to do as good as if you put it in the beater room and had the whole. But they were trying to get a coloring that would go on the calendars and color the paper evenly. So they sent me to school in Chicago. I went to Chicago for a week and studied some of the techniques that they were using there to get a color to stay fast on top of the paper. But as far as when I came back and tried it, it didn't seem to work on the type of calendars we had. So we colored most of the time in the beater room any color we wanted. We used a lot of yellow color and blue black. We run a lot of black paper lamp black. If you know what that is, it's about as black as you can ever get, and they get it on you and it's hard to get off. And of course, the beater room, once they use it back in the beater, they threw that in there to make the beaters black, and it sure did make the river black too. So that's why you probably, if you ever went along the consolidated waste bed out in the marsh out there, you could see this old black stuff. That was all due to the lamp black that they had thrown in there to make black paper. We made a lot of black paper, and all of these rolls that they made have calendar size on, and that was my job until the consolidated went down. but I forgot.
Well, what happened in the end to consolidate the paper company, and did they made any, for the people who were laid off eventually, did they do anything good for them?
If they, I don't know whether they laid anybody off, but a lot of them quit and went on other jobs because they could see the end coming. Whoever took the plant didn't put anything in it. Our main, Alvin DeVal, which was the millwright, he's the one that takes care of all the maintenance of mechanical parts on three machines. When he saw that, he quit and got another job. He got it back with some company in Toledo. And got out of there because he could see that the thing was coming, and I was up in age then, around over 60, around 61 or 2. So I didn't figure the change would do me much good, so I stayed with him, but I could see the end coming, and they didn't take care of, as far as giving a man, I'll tell you what we got, $3,000. We got over there for 43 years. That's what I got. I guess they gave all the thing. They went in bankruptcy, and when they rattled through the courts, and you know how they do, it was probably 5 years later or something like that. Well, we got about $3,000 out of it. No health insurance or nothing. We didn't get anything like that. So that was the end in 19...
Did you get a pension out of it?
The pension that I had was what I paid for when I was down there. I paid for the pension, and they wanted to know whoever wanted to keep paying for it, could keep paying for it. So I kept paying for my pension, but it's so small, it doesn't really amount to anything nowadays the way prices are.
So do I understand right that people who did not pay for a pension did not get a pension at all?
If the people did not pay for a pension, they did not get anything. They got out of there with that $3,000. That's all they got for the, no matter how many years. There were people there older than I. But when I left, I was probably the second oldest. There was one man, John Morrow, he was older than I, but he took care of the water. They had to keep him until they decided what they were going to do with the plant, which I never did care then. But they kept him to keep the water pipes from freezing. They had to somewhere or another keep fire prevention. But anyway, they tore the plant down.
In retrospect, how do you feel about the 43 years that you worked for this company?
Well, I don't think I got anywhere near what I should have. But what are you going to do? When I first went down there, it was the best company to work for in the city of Monroe. Most people will tell you. They pay good, they pay what I would say a decent wage and everything, but when I got out of there, they were the worst company, so.
Well, I thank you very much for this story.
I'm glad that at least you know that when I first started, I don't think I told you, but when I first started in 19, the regular job at number 7, I did not tell you this, but I worked 35 hours and I got $15.40 a week. Now that's not an hour, $15.40 a week. And when I left over there, I was getting probably 63 and 15 would be 78.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 78, I got out of there, I was getting about $6 an hour, $5.80 some an hour.
at least much better than where you started.
Well,
with.
A lot better than I started, but a lot less than what the other people were getting. But then, all in all, you just take what you can get, and that's what I did.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.